the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Fascinating today here in Nashville, Tennessee. We're doing the show live here from the Salem studio here, home studio for Richard Land Live and for Faith and Family. We are very glad to be talking to you here and glad to be talking across the nation. To join the conversation, you may call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Fascinating stuff in the news. For instance, we've got new reports out on the spirituality of the millennials. We've got a movement right now going on in Great Britain, pushing both sex education and euthanasia or assisted suicide. We've got an interesting debate in the United States about what makes the media liberal. And today on this program, we're going to be talking about one of those issues that always seems to come about to really raise the issue of the secularization of the academy. And that is, why does higher education seem to point persons in such a liberal direction? Why are, for instance, university faculty so often to the left by their own self-designation? Why do certain particular fields tend to point persons in a way that appears in terms of worldview to be more aligned with a liberal perspective? We're going to be talking about that. And this is going to be something we'll focus on, not just for today's program, but we'll take different aspects of this on some different programs as well. Today, I'm going to be having a running conversation with Rich Karlgaard, who is the publisher of Forbes magazine. And he published an article entitled The Blind Side, in which he argues that there are reasons why you have, for instance, a liberal environment in these special, elite sectors of the society, whether it's where you find the cultural creatives on both coasts, the East Coast especially having to do with news, the West Coast especially having to do with entertainment, and coast to coast, the elite universities that tend to be very, very liberal. Now, he suggests that that there are several things that factor into this, but he suggests that the liberal schools themselves have a lot to do with it, because most Americans receive their formal education from institutions that are liberal and progressive, and that means that the faculty basically are self-duplicating, self-replicating when it comes to worldview. And then this is buttressed, of course, by the liberal media and entertainment. Well, you're going to find a lot of the people who are especially the culture shapers, the opinion shapers in those sectors of the society, also drawn from the same numbers. And the point that Mr. Karlgaard makes, which is very interesting, is that there is an incredible insularity among the liberals. And it kind of gets to something else. You know, as conservatives, you got to read the liberal stuff and you got to read your stuff in order to know what it means to deal with these issues. But a lot of the liberals, they never actually even engage conservative arguments. And the liberal university is so liberal that in many departments, there's simply not a conservative there, even have a voice. And in many of the sectors where the cultural creatives are found, both coasts, both in the East Coast and in the West Coast, you're going to find that there really aren't very many conservative voices. And that's why, by the way, you get these statements such as the one infamously made by Pauline Kael years ago, the theater critic for the New York Times, when she said she didn't know anyone who voted for Ronald Reagan. She couldn't believe the man had been elected. And let's just recall, he wasn't merely elected. He was elected by a coast-to-coast landslide. Insularity is not a good thing in terms of worldview, whether you're a liberal or a conservative. But it turns out that the liberals tend to create kind of insular environments. This is not name-throwing or rock-throwing at liberals. This is an attempt at an understanding, an intellectual understanding of what's going on in those sectors of the society that do impact our families. When we send our kids to universities and colleges, when we put them out into the culture, it turns out that sometimes they're going into a place where the worldview is very, very different than what they know at home. We're going to be talking about what that means. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Very interesting news coming out of the Netherlands. A Dutch pastor who is an atheist will not be facing discipline for his atheism. This is the report out of Religion News Service. The pastor is not going to be punished or disciplined or removed from his pulpit, even though he describes himself now as an atheist. The pastor is Pastor Klaus Hendricks. He had written a book in which he declared that God does not exist. The title of his book is Believing in a God That Does Not Exist, The Manifesto of an Atheist Pastor. In the book, he distinguishes between believing in God, he says he sort of does, and believing in the existence of God, which he rejects. In other words, God's a symbol. This is one of the great, great tricks of modern theology. You're not talking about God as if he's actually an existent deity. You're talking about God as if he's some kind of metaphor or symbol that has some significance. Now, you know, this is just another reminder to us that the difference between theology and what you might call atheology or theism and atheism is not always the words, it's the meaning of the words. There are a lot of people in America who describe themselves as spiritual. And when you hear that, you would think that means that that they're affirming some sort of belief in God. But it isn't necessarily true at all. In this very New Age-influenced, postmodern-shaped society, there are people who say, I am a believer, I'm into spirituality, but it turns out they don't actually believe in the existence of any God. Now, that's scandalous enough, quite frankly, but the fact that you have a denomination here that decides that this is no big deal, that is huge. The panel of the church, Reformed Church Body, there in the Netherlands, it's the Protestant Church in the Netherlands, the official name of the organization of the church. It said, quote, the ideas of Hendricks are theologically not new and are in keeping with the liberal tradition that is an integral part of our church. You know, those are the words that lead directly to denominational death. When you have a denomination that says, look, we have a liberal part that's integral to our church, a liberal wing, and if they don't believe in God, that's no big surprise. But they're a part of us, and we're not going to take any action against a pastor who is an atheist. You know, an awful lot of church members, I don't care of the denomination, regardless of denomination or affiliation, when they consider the words atheist pastor, they at least recognize an oxymoron when they see it. That is two words which cannot comprehensibly be put together. But in this case, you have atheist pastor making sense not only to the atheist pastor, not only presumably to the church that employs him, but also to the denomination that's decided to take no action against him. Very, very interesting. How do we know about this? This is, after all, a relatively small church with a small issue in a small country. How is it that we know about it? Well, the answer to that, of course, is clear. It's the Internet. The Internet has become so important to the way we communicate, the way we live, social media, communication. It is now becoming one of the ways we get emergency help. Twitter has become a means of calling out for help, even reaching out on 911 calls. And that tells you something of how the Internet becomes so much a part of our lives. Robert Conquest, the historian, talks about non-consensual societies. Those are societies such as, well, right now you would point, for instance, to the People's Republic of China. And he points out that the Internet is the great enemy of these non-consensual societies. In other words, a dictatorship. If you are trying to run a decent dictatorship, you've got to maintain control over the communications. You've got to maintain control over the economy. You've got to maintain control over the politics. If you're not maintaining control over all those dimensions, you're not much of a dictator. You're not running much of a dictatorship. Well, in the age of the Internet, it's becoming more and more difficult to maintain that kind of a dictatorship because, as it turns out, the Internet is something like an acid that burns away, well, your ability to control the economy, your ability to control the politics, your ability to control communication. And once you lose all of those dimensions of control, it isn't long until you'll eventually lose control of even the, for instance, force of the military and all the rest. Because eventually, when you've got over a billion people in population, they will have their say. And here's the amazing thing. The Internet has allowed them, in many ways, to have their say. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, recently speaking on the Internet, said this is an important issue, and this she's absolutely right. And she went on to say, on their own, new technologies do not take sides in the struggle for freedom and progress, but the United States does. I appreciate that statement. I have to tell you, I've been very critical, and I'm sure many of you have had critical thoughts about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, for instance, when she was running for president. But let me tell you, as Secretary of State, she played this card exactly right. She represented the United States very well when she said, look, we're going to stand with this technology. The United States government takes a stand for liberty, and we're going to take a stand for the liberty of the Internet and for people to have access to the Internet and for people to be able to publish free speech on the Internet. We're going to take a stand against restrictions on the Internet, restrictions on citizen ability to access news and communications. And you know what? I think our Secretary of State's onto something pretty smart here because she realizes that the Internet is on our side. In other words, the Internet is on the side of freedom. Eventually, people who can communicate can mobilize. Once they mobilize, they can coalesce into a powerful political force. Once they coalesce into a powerful political force, it's going to be very difficult for any dictatorship to manage that. and restrain its power. I think that's very, very interesting. And I at least found that that was a word of encouragement to me, just thinking about the world scene. You know, the internet brings all kinds of things we don't want into our lives. That's why parents must be very vigilant about issues from internet pornography to all the rest. You can launch a conspiracy theory on the net. You can tell lies on the internet. You can broadcast on the World Wide Web ideas that are helpful and true and healthy, or those that are poisonous and dangerous and subversive. But in the end, the information has a way of getting free, as the old motto goes. And the internet is making it very difficult, even for dictatorships, to keep information from getting free. And it is right, I promise you it's right, to be on the right side of this issue and the right side of history. We're going to come back to talk about why it is that certain sectors of our society pull people very much to the left. We'll be right back with the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Very interesting article by Rich Karlgaard, the publisher of Forbes magazine. Forbes is one of those magazines that from time to time really does have a very interesting angle or aspect of what's going on in the culture. Now, the background to this particular column entitled Digital Rules, the Blind Side, is the fact that Mr. Karlgaard is suggesting that President Obama has run into some difficult political water because he doesn't really listen to conservative voices. He doesn't really hear conservative opinions, and therefore his frame of reference is all in one direction. He's surrounded by a staff that kind of, insulates him in that direction. He is surrounded by friends who continue him in that direction and speak to him from a very liberal perspective. And the leaders of Congress that he tends to meet with are the leaders in Congress who are also the leaders of the Democratic Party, who share his own liberal worldview, or at least far more liberal worldview. Now, the purpose of this program is not just to throw stones at liberalism. Those are important words we need to clarify. When we speak about liberalism here, well, you know, that word could mean anything from lovers of liberty going all the way back to the American Revolution, siding with freedom and liberty over against the monarchy. But we're talking about it in terms of its more modern meaning, which is pushing towards a progressive understanding of life, progressive being the word that they prefer, suggesting that the purpose of humanity is to find ever greater liberation from constraints. And that means that all constraints, basically, are at least under suspicion, including the constraints that conservatives, there's the other word, tend to think are the very essence of what makes a society social, of what makes a culture work, of where you find truth and meaning. And so that's the collision. Now, there's some shorthand to this. Of course, liberals are far more prone, at least in terms of a generalization, to believe that government is a part of the solution, whereas conservatives are more likely to see government in many ways as part of the problem. When it comes to human nature, liberals tend to think that that what human beings need more than anything else is a more paternalistic society, whereas conservatives tend to be at least more libertarian with a little L, in understanding that the more government you have, the more dangerous is the concentration of power in that government. But nonetheless, there are very easy ways to understand the differences between, well, the map of our states that are coded blue and red, the political parties, Democratic and Republican, that include the majority of Americans, one at least more liberal and one at least more conservative. And even in the media and in the educational world, you have certain institutions, certain sources that are branded either more conservative, more liberal. Now, the point of Mr. Karlgaard is this. When you look at where people go to school, when you consider the media that they watch and consume, when you consider whether or not they're involved in the apparatus of government or whether they're in a politically correct workplace, you're pretty well going to be able to define whether they're in an insular liberal environment or not. And that, I think, is a very, very interesting insight. Let me tell you how this plays out. You have, again, and his main point is that if you are in these sectors, much like what he would say is the White House right now, if you're in one of these liberal schools as a faculty member, if you are indeed in the liberal media and establishment as a figure, if you are in the government, and if you are in the workplace in one of these places where political correctness is found, then you might be in a place where you're not even hearing a conservative argument. You might be in a place where you're not even hearing from conservative voices, and you don't know. And that's why people from the left tend to be routinely surprised at how conservative the American people are. Have you noticed it really doesn't work the other way? Rarely do you have conservative figures going, wow, I had no idea America was that liberal. I mean, you almost never have that happen. But on the other side, it seems to happen pretty often. The election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts, of all things Massachusetts, people in Massachusetts going, wow. The leaders in Washington going, how did that happen? And you find it again and again and again. And I'm going to suggest that Mr. Cargard is onto something here, and he's onto something that Christians ought to take with some particular seriousness, because one of our aims at discipleship is intellectual integrity. And that means we've got to be very, very careful that when we engage issues, when we are involved in government and politics, making a vote, involved in public debate, when we are deciding where to send our children to college or university, when we're deciding what media we're going to watch or observe or how we're going to engage the arts and entertainment, we're basically making decisions about what kind of worldview we're going to engage. And here's the other thing. You're making a decision about how much you're going to allow yourself to be changed by this. Is that a word of warning? You bet. Here's a little hint. If you're ready to send your 18-year-old off to a very college, a very liberal college or university, and you think that will have no effect on them, you're absolutely wrong. I mean, wrong in a way that's both naive and horribly dangerous. Because if you put someone in a peer context that is very liberal, and all they hear there are liberal voices, then they're going to be in a position where their whole frame of reference is going to be shifted left. Now, I guess if I were talking to a liberal audience about the danger of having your kids turn conservative, I would say you better be careful sending them to a ubiquitously, consistently, overwhelmingly conservative school, or you're going to risk they're going to turn out to be conservatives. The problem is there aren't many of those conservative schools that liberals have to be worried about. But there are a lot of liberal schools that conservatives need to be worried about, because liberal faculties replicate themselves. And that's why, did you see the New York Times story just a few weeks ago? The vast majority of American professors paint themselves on the left. In other words, this isn't some conservative calling names. This is liberal faculty saying, you bet we are, and making arguments as to why it would be so. It's a fascinating thing. When you start looking at this, you realize that we're all in our own worldview. The difference is whether or not we know we are, and if we work at having integrity to make certain that our worldview is right. You know, that takes a conversation. That takes a corrective. And if all we hear is what we already know and what we already believe, then that's not going to happen. And you look at these liberal faculty, they're continually shocked by how conservative the American people are. They're continually amazed and dismayed. I remember reading Tom Franks. He wrote an entire book entitled What's Wrong with Kansas? Because he was just trying to explain why people in Kansas keep voting for conservatives. And he said, look, this is ridiculous. Why do they keep doing this? But they keep doing it over and over again. And it's because, Mr. Franks, that's America. America's far more conservative than you think. But if you live in a very liberal enclave and you go to liberal schools and you watch only the liberal media, then you can be in trouble. Let me make a suggestion as to how conservatives can avoid that kind of box. First of all, make sure that we don't live in our own closed off box. You need to watch something you're going to disagree with from time to time. Conservative Christians need to watch some of the liberal media from time to time to know what arguments are being made. That's right. Go on over to MSNBC if you dare. Just go over and watch for a little bit. And you're going to discover that these people believe what they're saying. They actually do. They're not making it up. They actually believe what they're saying. And they're making arguments. You watch Rachel Maddow. She's making arguments. She really is. And they're arguments that, by and large, you're going to disagree with. But if you're not prepared to even be aware of what they're saying and how those arguments are framed, then you're not going to be in any position with any kind of intellectual integrity or honesty to argue against it. You know, we need to be very, very certain as Christians that we do not tie ourselves up in a little box where we only talk to ourselves and we only listen to things we already agree with, because otherwise we could fall into the very same pattern. Are you thinking about this? Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. It is fascinating. You send someone off to a liberal school. If all they hear is a liberal argument, buttressed by liberal media, entertained by liberal Hollywood, why would you be surprised that their worldview would change? It's an important issue not only for intellectual defense, it's an important issue for intellectual integrity. Let's figure out how we engage these things and do so with honesty. The phone number 877-893-8255. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. What do you do to make certain you're just not listening to yourself? In terms of understanding what's going on, current events, media, communications, higher education, you name it. How do you know that you're not just hearing what you want to hear? I've suggested that, this article by Rich Karlgaard of Forbes indicates that liberals tend to be very, very insular. Well, conservatives probably less so because we're surrounded by liberal voices in higher education and the media and all the rest. But the danger is still there. And I'd just like to know, because I'm going to make some suggestions when we come to the end of this hour of some things we can do to avoid just living in a little encapsulated conservative kind of hideaway. How is it that we can make sure we're listening to other voices so that we know how responsibly to enter the conversation, so we know how, indeed, to counter some of the arguments that are being made? Allatoona, Pennsylvania. Mike's on the line. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Albert. I was going to comment, because I can only comment on higher education, but you had started off the program questioning why so many liberals in higher education.
Right.
I was thinking it's because they're following through on their worldview. We all know that the world isn't perfect, so how do we make it better? A liberal understanding would be to educate people. If you give them all the right choices, they'll make the correct answers or the correct choices.
You know, Mike, there's an incredible amount of wisdom in that. Go ahead. You had more to say. Go ahead.
Higher education in order to change the world. Now, Christians, we get more diluted. We think we can change the world through telling people about Jesus Christ, and that's how we can change people. So we'll find more of those in the churches than in higher education.
Mike, I would have loved to have you as a guest. I mean, that's an incredibly cogent and well-presented argument, and especially to the first point of the issues we've been talking about here. Yes, if you believe that the main problem facing humanity is ignorance or a lack of education, then providing education is a way to do that. And by the way, that was the great theme of the Enlightenment. That's indeed how the great historical epic of the Enlightenment, especially in the 18th century, got its name, Enlightenment. You can think of it kind of like turning the light on, which is a way we even, in cartoons, metaphor, understanding, the light bulb over the head goes on. There you have it. Big idea. If you think that education is the way to improve humanity, solve humanity's deepest needs, then you'll end up there. And you know what? Conservatives, too, believe in education. We believe that education is important. We believe, indeed, that God made us as creatures who are knowing creatures and understanding creatures. The Bible honors knowledge, increasing in knowledge, increasing in understanding. The Bible certainly honors wisdom over folly, but the Bible doesn't point to education as salvation. And that is a big distinction, and I think Mike's onto something very, very important there. I think if you really believe that you can change the world by education, then you're going to end up there. Whereas Christians, I think, as Mike put it, he said, we have other things that are on our mind, including things that are even more important on our hearts, including sharing the gospel. That gospel centrality certainly keeps us from seeing education in messianic terms. Fascinating stuff, absolutely fascinating stuff. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You know, when you send a kid to college, and they land on the university campus, by and large, they're going to be taught by liberal faculty. That's just the way it works. And I mentioned that faculty replicate themselves. The faculty is kind of like a labor union. It in academic terms, is called a guild. And the faculty basically hire people like themselves. And that's why, over a period of time, the secularization of America's, especially elite sectors in education, has meant that they've also become overwhelmingly liberal. Now, there's some isolated conservatives, some very prominent conservatives. You know, you could have Leon Cass at the University of Chicago, Robbie George at Princeton University, You can point to people like that and say they really do make a difference. Harvey Mansfield at Harvard, very conservative. Marianne Glendon, Harvard Law School, very conservative. You can look at that and say, well, there are conservatives there too. That's right. But the vast majority of the faculty, by their own self-designation, indicate that they're liberal. Now, if you're a conservative, you're going to have to come to know liberal ideas. You're going to have to be able to counter liberal arguments, or you're going to be dead meat on the university campus. But if you're a liberal and you go there, you can avoid taking a conservative. Just think of it this way. A conservative student can't avoid taking liberals, but a liberal student can easily avoid taking conservatives as professors. You know, that's not all bad, is it? I mean, let's face it. From the perspective of Christian apologetics, that's not all bad. So long as we send students who are grounded in the truth, grounded in the faith, and ready to enter the battle of ideas, well, that's what we're throwing them into. The problem is there are an awful lot of Christian parents who are naive and are sending out kids that don't know and are unprepared, and you can imagine what happens then. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. How are you going to make certain that you aren't just listening to yourself and arguments you already agree with? Let me make some suggestions. And I'm speaking particularly here to Christians, and I'm speaking to Christians who are more likely to identify themselves as conservatives than liberals. So this advice would work for both sides, but let me just suggest I'm tilting this particularly at conservative Christians. Every once in a while, you need to read something other than the normal literature you read. And so it would do you well from time to time to look at the New York Times, to look at the editorial page of the New York Times, just to get an issue of the New York Times and take it apart and try to figure out, all right, this newspaper is targeted towards America's largest city with about 18 million people in the metropolitan area. It is the nation's opinion leader in terms of newsprint. What happens in the old gray lady, as she is known in the New York Times, really sets the stage for what much of the media is going to think, how they're going to consider a story to be important or unimportant. The editorial page, which is predictably liberal and has been for the last 50 years, ever since the Roosevelt administration, is a barometer of America's liberal thought. Look, it only costs about $1.25 for a daily edition. You can just walk down. Starbucks sells the New York Times. You can just walk down, buy a copy, sit down and read it. And you're going to discover a worldview that's very, very different than perhaps what you know. You need to look at some of the magazines. You know, if you're going to be ready to have a conversation about what's going on in the world, you ought to at least look at Time and Newsweek. I used to say Times, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report, but U.S. News and World Report's no longer a Newsweekly, so it's down to Time and Newsweek. Both of them tend to be rather liberal. Time, by the way, started out as conservative and turned more liberal. But nonetheless, they are both big opinion shapers. And when you look at those magazines, you look at what's on the front cover, it's going to tell you this is where, at least this Newsweekly, thinks the attention should be this week. And that's prime real estate in the media. But, you know, an awful lot of Americans get most of their media exposure from television. And I'll tell you, there are a lot of conservatives who just are accustomed to watching the local news. And then enduring whatever they have to with that, and then as they're settling in for their news content, they just reflexively turn to Fox News, the Fox News Channel. And the Fox News Channel is a brilliant piece of American television. Roger Ailes, putting together the Fox News program, knew exactly what he was doing. After all, this is a man who worked with Ronald Reagan. He knows America. And so when he put together Fox, he put together a news network that was aimed right at those red states, aimed right at middle America, aimed right at the Morning in America crowd who are going to be looking for the kind of news that's typically without the liberal cynicism and that's far more conservative. But let me tell you, there are an awful lot of conservatives who watch Fox without realizing that there's a distinction between being a conservative and being a libertarian. And you look at some of those issues that are bandied about. We're going to take some programs in coming days to talk about how to recognize the difference between a conservative and a libertarian, because it comes out in issues that might surprise you. Libertarian candidate for the United States Senate in Kentucky was asked a question about the partial birth abortion ban. He said he probably would have voted for it. Probably? I mean, that's an amazing statement. There's a difference between a conservative and a libertarian understanding on these issues, and it comes out oftentimes in Fox News, and people don't recognize it. But let's face it, on Fox, you're getting a fairly conservative aspect on the media. CNN, more liberal than Fox. MSNBC, well, it's kind of the polar opposite. And that's where if you're a conservative watching MSNBC, it might make your blood pressure go up, but it will also make you hear the chatter you're not going to hear elsewhere. And it used to be that radio was this way. You had more conservative networks, more liberal networks, and you'd have to go tracking around to listen. But now on the television, I guarantee you take those three major news networks. You got Fox on the right, MSNBC on the left, and CNN somewhere in between. And that probably depends on which hour you're watching CNN. But if you look over at MSNBC, let me tell you, if you listen to that for a bit, you're going to know this conversation makes sense to a lot of Americans. Now, let me tell you, it is not healthy for our democracy that we just kind of zero in on one voice and listen to that one voice. We need to be listening to what's going on out there in order to hone our arguments, in order to be able to know not only what we believe, but why we believe what we believe, and how it is we could translate that into meaningful arguments in the public square. We need to teach our children how to do this. And by the way, if you teach your children how to engage these issues, as they're even before you on the television, they're going to be in much better shape to arrive on the college and university campus, armed with the kind of reasoning to know, here's how I hear an argument, here's how I recognize where it's coming from, here's how I do an autopsy on it and figure out whether I agree with it or not, here's how I can trace it back to the worldview that makes this make sense. Now, that's a skill that your own children can develop with your assistance, even as you watch the news, as you look at the newspaper, as you might look at one of the news magazines. Folks, there's a big responsibility out there. And I look at this argument by Rich Karlgaard, and I say, you know, if I were a liberal, I think I would read this article and see it as a word that was important for me. Rich Karlgaard is writing about the blind side. He says that the problem with many American liberals is that they're simply not aware of their blind side. They are unaware of the fact that they're not listening to the people who vote in all these red states, the vast mainstream of Americans, and thus they're continually surprised, if not tackled by, the understanding that Americans are far more conservative than they thought they were. In other words, America is not like the cocktail party circuit for the cultural elites in Hollywood or in New York City. But my warning to each of us is that conservatives can play the equal and opposite problem. Now, I agree with Rich Karlgaard. It's less likely simply because we're surrounded by so many liberal voices in the media and academia and all the rest, but it's still possible. Intellectual integrity is a matter of our Christian discipleship, not only because we want to know that we believe the right things for the right reasons, but also because we understand that ideas really do have consequences. And thus, when we enter these debates and we consider these issues, it's not just because we find them interesting. It's because we believe that human happiness and well-being is literally at stake. Folks, there's a big world out there. There are all kinds of media options. There are all kinds of media sources. I began early in the hour by talking about how the internet is the enemy of dictatorship. The reality is that there's no one today. If you're listening to this program, I promise you, there is no one today who does not have access to more sources in the media, more sources of information, not to mention entertainment, than ever before. We just need to be aware that our choices really do matter, and our ability to engage in a public discussion means we've got to be listening at least some of the time to arguments that are not our own. Fascinating thing. I think this article about Rich Karlgaard is unlikely to be read by liberals for one very important reason. They're unlikely to read Forbes magazine, which is one reason why we need to be reminded every once in a while conservatives do need to read liberal magazines. It's kind of like William F. Buckley used to say, if you're going to be really intelligent in terms of public debate, you got to read the other side's mail. Back of final thoughts. This is the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. Very interesting article in the New York Times. I don't know if you saw this. The headline is, he breaks for band recitals. It's about President Obama and the fact that he tends to interrupt even the affairs of state for events that have to do with his children. And especially, of course, speaking here of Malia and Sasha, his children now 11 and 8. Very interesting article. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, writing in the New York Times, says that Well, as David Axelrod of the White House staff says, there are certain things that are sacrosanct on his schedule. Kids' recitals, soccer games, basketball games, school meetings. These are circled in red on his calendar, and regardless of what's going on, he's going to make those. I think that's part of how he sustains himself through all this. Very, very interesting. You know, there is something very admirable in all of this. And the New York Times, after all, big into work, big into business, big into politics, at least recognizes there's something, well, admirable about a president who says, I am also a father, and I'm not going to neglect my responsibility as father in order to be president. And, well, this article goes into some very interesting things about how even meetings about the war in Afghanistan have been interrupted while he's gone out to an event with his family, or gone as he goes every evening at 6 o'clock to have dinner with his wife and family. According to this article, he's given his scheduler strict instructions that if he must have nighttime activities that are to take place after 8 p.m., that includes matters of war. In November, as the commander-in-chief wrestled with sending more troops to Afghanistan, he called an 8 p.m. meeting of his national security team in deference to his role as father-in-chief. Now, this isn't uncomplicated because, for one thing, all the people who are having to move their schedules to fit his, well, some of them are fathers and mothers, too. It's a complicated world. I understand that. It's a complicated job being president of the United States, and no doubt there are going to be some complicated times when he's not going to be able to do what he here is establishing a precedent to do. But I think it's important when we see a story like this, we recognize wherever we see family honored, wherever we see marriage honored, wherever we see a father's responsibility to his children honored, we need to honor that. You know, there are an awful lot of fathers who could actually do well by following this example and understanding that if the president of the United States can interrupt a meeting in order to say, I have to go because something important is happening with my child. I have to go home at dinner and have dinner with my wife and children. If the president of the United States can do that, something tells us that most of the rest of us need to do it far more often when we often will cite far flimsier excuses. I disagree with the president on policy matters night and day, as it turns out. But when it comes to something like this, I have to say hats off, Mr. President. Go to the band recital. Some other things can wait. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation on Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mueller Program. Thanks to the folks here, especially to Matt and Amber. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.